You're listening to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Have you plowed through all those books that people gave you over the holidays? Me too. Time to tee off on your next wave of winter reads. Every year, the Library of Michigan compiles a list of Michigan notable books. We're talking stories about Michigan or set here, and also those written by Michigan authors. Today, we're welcoming two of the librarians involved in the selection process. Tim Gleisner is Manager of Special Collections at the Library of Michigan. Tim, how are you doing?
I'm good today. Thank you, April.
And Jessica Trotter is a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. Jessica, thanks for being here.
Thanks for having us.
All these books have to have some connection to Michigan, whether they are about Michigan or written by someone who's from here. But that word that you use to title the list, notable, it is wonderfully flexible. What, in your view, makes a book really notable? What boxes does it have to tick as you're reading it?
I'll start. I guess for me, one thing that really stands out for many of the books that we choose is just something that it's hard to really put your arms around it, but basically just, you know, when you read it, you know it. Like, you absolutely know it. Or if you see the book, one of the books I'm going to talk about today, as soon as I saw it, I mean, I knew it was a notable book. And usually the committee overall has that same feeling.
Jessica, how would you answer that question?
I understand what Tim is talking about, but also for me, there's a bit of relevance that pops out for me. I'm thinking of a couple of the titles, actually, including the titles that Tim's going to talk about. There's just something about them that speaks to the year that we're looking at or the year that we're looking forward to. There's things that just hit me because they are so identifiable to me as Michigan and just also have a great story or a great, you know, premise, whatever type of book it is.
And actually, I would jump on what Jessica is saying. I mean, I completely agree with her because there were two titles from last year's list that would not, I think, really be as relevant for this year. And we would have passed on just due to the topic and the currency of the topic.
Right. I don't know that we'd have passed on them this year.
There's one from this year, and I guess I can give the title, The Girls, about the Larry Nassar case that just was something that just, I mean, you knew, but when you read it, you absolutely were like, yes, we have to have this book. But the currency of it was just something that, I mean, you had to look at it at the very least to just know that it was a title for this year.
Do you think there are things that set the Great Lakes literary tradition apart?
I mean, I think the question of water, you know, just the lakes themselves, a book that won Death and Life of the Great Lakes. I mean, I think that's something that really stands out for me. And then really books that I've seen, industrial settings, for some reason that pops out in my mind. But Jessica, I'm sure, can speak.
Oh, I'm kind of thinking about some of the ones that we're looking at this year and thinking more about. There's a Michigan twist on Midwest that I think...
Oh, as a Buckeye, I really am curious to hear what you mean by that. Could you say more?
Well, in a way, it's kind of going into one of the books that I want to talk about. So there are books where it's very clear that the person is sort of coming from somewhere else and trying to get used to the Midwest. And, you know, part of it's just pulling in the iconic things that have shaped Michigan, such as everything going on in Detroit, the industrial part of it, the cultural Motown, things like that. I mean, it just pulls a little different to me than maybe some of the other Midwestern states.
Well, let's get to it, Jessica. What's the book that you have in mind about this?
This one's actually "Come See About Me, Marvin." It's poems by Brian G. Gilmore. This one really hit me. Gilmore's, he's from D.C. originally, and he came to Michigan to teach social justice law at MSU. And this collection is sort of that getting to know you part of, you know, adjusting to Michigan. And it's presented as sort of a dialogue with Marvin Gaye.
Oh, wow.
Who also left D.C. to further his career and ended up in the Midwest, first in Chicago and then in Detroit.
I think a lot of people may get a little intimidated by poetry. They worry that they won't get it. What's your pitch to people for picking up this book?
This one's so accessible. It's so, part of it's very clearly mid-Michigan. Not totally, but there are things that are just very clearly mid-Michigan. He's talking about places I can identify on the road on I-96, like his first winter bad weather driving, was going to a presentation in Grand Rapids and hitting, there is a spot on I-96, which I have hit, I don't know how many times, that ice is over before you get to an emergency exit. And it's just, it's like I can see it in this particular set of poems. He does just a very good job of bringing very real places to life.
Is there something from the book you could read to us?
Yeah. There are a number that are just, I think my favorites are probably very long. But actually, this one is the Grand Rapids poem. It's called Grand Rapids for KK. I'm just going to read a first stanza of it.
Sure.
And then the snow came, like in that book, into thin air. And I was happy we weren't climbing the Himalayas. I was just on my way to Grand Rapids to do a seminar on discrimination. And we were just about there when someone tossed a white bed sheet on our windshield and our tires became skates on a sheet of ice. Now I knew why much of the time on these trips you could look to the right or left and you could see cars in the trees, driver out, airbags engaged, cell phone in the air.
That's amazing.
And that goes on. That's actually a longer poem. And it's just one of those things where you're like, I know exactly the spot he's talking about. I have driven past those cars and I know that situation.
Tim, one of the books that you chose is a cookbook this year. Mm-hmm. It's called Roughage, A Practical Guide to Vegetables. Will you tell us a little bit more about the author, Abra Behrens?
Well, Abra is a chef and farmer here in Michigan, currently in Three Oaks, previously in Northport up in the Leelanau Peninsula, and then also over, she was trained over at Zingerman's Deli. And the reason why I said earlier that there are books that you just know that are notable titles, I knew seeing this book, and I'm not a cookbook person. When I looked at this book, the first thing before I even looked at the recipes was, this book is beautiful. Just in the format that it's in, the cover itself, the illustrations, just the way it's broken up by, you know, the sections or chapters by vegetable, one vegetable, discrete vegetable per chapter. So Abra Behrens is this person who very much believes in seasonal, eating, and it's just a wonderful book broken up with different vignettes of her life with experiences of cooking. One very powerful one is in the section about broccoli, where her father is like literally cooking to heal himself. And she shares that experience with him cooking bacon after the passing of her mother, his wife. I can't speak enough about this book. For me, this was like the one of them where I just basically am like, yep, that's a notable book.
Have you made any of the dishes from the book yet?
Yeah, I've made two dishes. One was broccoli, fitting enough, because I love broccoli. And it was really just essentially, basically dousing it oil, chili flakes, roasting the broccoli with the chili oil or the oil and the chili flakes, and then basically grating Parmesan cheese on it. That was my dinner that one night when I made that. And then another one was carrots, again, roasting, but this time with a jam and almonds. And it was just a fantastic meal. And the one thing I love about her recipes is she speaks to someone like me, where she says, if you're going to, douse these in oil, use a glug of oil, and like I can picture in my mind what a glug is, right? Like you just kind of shoot the oil in the bowl and then right? And so, I mean, it's very simple, easy for someone like me who, quite frankly, when it comes to vegetables, if it's not out of a frozen bag when I get home at night, I really don't do much else. Yeah, I just can't speak enough about this book.
That sounds amazing. Jessica, another one of your favorites from the list is The Care and Feeding of Ravenously Hungry Girls by Anissa Gray. She gets my vote for best title, by the way.
Yes.
Now,
yes.
Anissa Gray grew up in Western Michigan, and that's where the book's set. It covers
St. Joseph.
Right. It covers the lives of three sisters. What's going on when we meet these women?
This is just in the aftermath of Althea and her husband, so the oldest sister and her husband, have just been arrested and convicted for defrauding their West Michigan community. And the two younger sisters are coming into town to look after their nieces. They have two nieces. And it's a family in crisis. And it's everything is bringing out all the faults that have shaped this family. Mm. And it's just starting to crumble, and people will come through stronger, but it looks at relationships between mothers and daughters. Althea, basically, her basically raised her sisters, especially her baby sister. So it's mothers and daughters. It's relationships between siblings. There's a lot about issues of identity and body image, guilt and regrets. And it's one of those things. It was compared to The Mothers by Britt Bennett and T.R.I. Jones's An American Marriage.
Another couple of books about family.
Exactly. And and for me, it was a surprisingly fast read for something that's so emotionally weighty. There's discussion of eating disorders. There's a lot going on in it.
Could you contrast it a bit with the two books by T.R.I. Jones and Britt Bennett that we just mentioned? What corners of family and identity does it explore that maybe we haven't seen anywhere else?
Well, the youngest sister has an eating disorder that she has been she's basically backslid on as these events are happening. She is split from a partner. She's in the Chicago area and coming up into West Michigan to help with the children it's a teenager who basically turned her mother and father in. She's sort of the whistleblower on this crime.
Wow.
And yeah, I mean, so you've got all sorts of things going on. It's just the sisters part of it and how that family dynamic of how if you lose a parent early, those relationships get really screwed up in that, you know, an oldest child maybe raising the youngest child, that middle child gets somewhere lost in between. It's just a really interesting look at those relationships.
It sounds like one that'll stick with us for a long time.
It was actually the first thing I read last year, and I really, it never let go in that sense. I was really fought for this one. I really, really wanted to make sure nothing happened and it made the list.
There was a strong contingent on the committee
yes,
for that book.
Yes, they loved it. Yes.
They wanted that book beyond all else. Yeah.
Tim, I wanted to ask about another one of your picks. It's a nonfiction title called A Good American Family, The Red Scare and My Father, by David Moranis. He's an associate editor at the Washington Post. What's the Michigan connection here?
Well, it's a trial that takes place back in the early 1950s in Detroit. Basically, it's during the Red Scare of the early 50s, the McCarthy era. And really, the Michigan connection is Elliot Moranis, the father of David, basically is put on trial for being a supposed communist at that time because of past connections that he had earlier in life while he was attending school at U of M. For me, this is one of those books that really, when Jessica talks about, you know, this is a Michigan book, and really, like, you know, the setting of it, I'm not a native Michigander, but I don't think you could put this in my native state of Wisconsin, even my native hometown in Milwaukee. This is a Detroit story. The one that stands out to me the most is the grandmother who was the FBI informant in the local communist headquarters. And she for years was taking notes and passing along information on all these different people that she was coming into contact with, you know, in Detroit in the 30s and 40s, and basically keeping files on all of them, and nobody knew. Nobody had a clue. Nobody had an inkling of this woman who really was embedded, you know, in the labor movement, the left movement of that time in Detroit. And it just, the sheer volume of sources and notes and research that David Moranis did on this book, and the cast of characters, how they all came to Detroit, it really paints a scene of Detroit of being so diverse, grabbing so many people from so many different parts of the country who really made up that city, you know, from the large African-American population to the people who were coming from, you know, the rural Appalachian area, all mingling into this one urban setting, and then just really seeing, like, the scare, the Red Scare, not in Washington, D.C., like how we see it on TV today, you know, with McCarthy and everything else, but here in the center of the country, in Detroit, you know, which was the labor capital of the United States, is, probably still is today, you know, but I mean, it was just amazing.
Yeah, it seems like a little different picture of Detroit in the 50s than a lot of us have, you know, that level of betrayal and division.
Well, and, you know, and I think it was really endemic of the country as a whole, but to me, it was just, I think the thing to me is how complex that city is. You know, having lived in Michigan now for 20 years, I still sometimes can't get my head around Detroit. Detroit is a very complex, has a very extremely complex history. And this book, you know, touches on an aspect of it, in a time and a place that obviously was fraught with many divisions in our society. And I think that's another thing that really touched me was just looking at our current state of affairs today, you know, and realizing this has happened before. And you know, this is something that, you know, maybe will happen again. Hopefully not. But if it does, you know, it's not the end of the world. There is hope. Again, this is one where after reading maybe 100, 150 pages, I'm like, this is a notable book.
Mm-hmm. You know, you touched on this with something you said before, but I have to ask, are the conversations when the committee gets together and really starts getting down to brass tacks about which books are going to make the list, are those friendly conversations or what's the room like?
They can be. No, they can be. I think sometimes people get very passionate about certain books. Mm-hmm. Another one that we knew that was extremely notable was Broke. And I know, you know, that's a different title altogether. But Broke was one that people got very passionate about in the last meeting. Like, yep, that one has to stay on. Mm-hmm. And it was about the bankruptcy of Detroit. But I think overall it's amicable. There are emotions do run high for certain books, certainly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. We tend to think of the literary centers of the United States as the cities where big publishing and big entertainment writing is centered. And obviously, there's a million great books coming out of New York and LA, the places where a lot of writers go to pursue their careers. But what do you feel like readers get out of reading local?
Part of it's just a better understanding of what's going on around you or what's happened. One of the examples would be The World According to Fannie Davis. That book was really interesting to me. My father grew up in Detroit. I've lived most of my life, actually, in Lansing. But I'm reading this book about a woman whose mother ran numbers in Detroit in the African-American community. And I finished it, and I turned to my father and said the next time I saw him and said, so I've been told everybody did, but did you guys play numbers? And he's like, before I'd even finished the question, he's trying to come up with the name of the lady who would come and take their bets every day. She's sort of like stop in for tea type thing. And it was just neat. It just led to a really interesting conversation. But it was just a part that it was very intrinsic to him growing up, but I knew nothing about it.
Yeah.
Jessica Trotter is a librarian with the Capital Area District Library. We've also been talking with Tim Gleisner, manager of special collections at the Library of Michigan. They are part of the shadowy cabal of readers and curators who bring us the list of Michigan notable books every year. You two, thank you so much. I know I'm going to be busy for the next couple of months.
Thanks, April.
Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
We have some interviews for you to listen to with some of the authors whose books are on this year's Michigan Notable Books list. Head over to the Michigan Radio website to find them.